All right.
The meeting will come to order. I think we will want to get started with Representative Clark. Bill, at this point, would you like to move your bill?
I will, Madam Chair. Thank you. I'd like to move House File 1732 to be laid over for consideration in the Omnibus Committee bill that we'll be talking about a little bit later.
Thank you. To your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm really proud to bring this bill today. You know, we're talking a lot in the legislature this year about reforms and the kinds of things that we need to do to deal with shared sacrifice and the problems of not having enough resources for all the things we need to do. It's always good then when we have a proposal that really helps us figure out how to focus in on some of the ways that can not only serve some of the issues that we care about in terms of justice and the need to really give people chances in our society, but also save us money, and is a very good investment. So I'm really pleased to bring before you the bill that talks about the Network for Better Futures, and I have the pleasure of introducing a few people today who are going to take you through what the Network for Better Futures is actually working on, and specifically how it relates to this committee in terms of health and housing. So I guess we'll start with Mr. Crossford.
Good morning. My name is Steve Thomas, and thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of House File 1732, which will provide continued funding for an ambitious demonstration project for high-risk adults. My name is Steve Thomas, and I'm the President and CEO of the Network for Better Futures. And I'm joined at the table today by Makram El-Amin, one of our team leaders, Mr. Stuart Hudson, one of our staff people, and two representatives from our network community, Mr. Derek Bacon and Vincent Britton. Derek and Vincent represent the over 120 formerly homeless men currently enrolled in the network. The men in our community are all employed, and they're actively engaged in making better life for themselves, their families, and our community. During its 2007 session, the legislature had the foresight to invest a modest amount of state funds in our bold, cost-effecting and cost-saving endeavor. And I'm very pleased to report that we have met or exceeded all the performance expectations that were set for us. Quite simply, we have emerging evidence that the network is a proven means for reducing state spending, creating new jobs, and achieving much better results for an expensive group of high-risk consumers of public services. This morning, we'd like to introduce you to our innovative enterprise and summarize some key performance highlights from our first year of service. We will close by making a case for continuing to invest in our enterprise in spite of the current fiscal crisis. First, some background. The network is reducing the economic and social cost of high-risk adults, primarily African-American men, with histories of incarceration, substance abuse, mental illness, chronic unemployment, and homelessness. This ambitious endeavor was created and being sponsored by a team of Minnesota's leading healthcare, housing, workforce, community corrections, and human service practitioners. A core feature of our venture is Better Futures Enterprises, and we passed around a brochure for Better Futures Enterprises. This is our business unit, which creates jobs for the high-risk unemployed group of adults that we enroll, and it provides immediate short-term employment. By setting high expectations and providing direct access to the resources one needs to meet these expectations, namely housing, health insurance, behavioral health and primary health care, and short-term employment and community re-engagement, men in the network are offered the opportunity to become contributing, productive, and positive members of society. Each man is expected to transform from a client to totally dependent on public care to a worker who earns a wage, pays taxes, child support, and restitution. The core ingredients of the network's approach is also a proven means for ending homelessness, increasing earned income and child support payments, and for reducing prison recidivism and criminal activity. And during the next biennium, we're willing to share some of the financial risk if these better results are not achieved. And now, McCrom will just take a few minutes to share some of our performance highlights from 2008, and then I'll close out our testimony.
Thank you. Could you please state your name for the record?
McCrom El-Amin.
Thank you. Proceed.
Thank you, Steve, and good morning. I am Makram El-Amin, team leader for the Network for Better Futures, and I'm pleased to present some of the initial data regarding the performance of our enterprise in 2008. We formally launched our endeavor last January, and during our first 12 months, we've enrolled 224 high-risk men, and 136, or 60% of these men, were enrolled under our contract with the Department of Corrections. About 70% of these men meet the state's definition of long-term homelessness, and a third of the legislature's appropriation was used to provide housing. We now master lease over 130 apartments and provide rental subsidies for all participants. This enables men to secure and afford the type of quality housing that they rarely have access to on the open market. All of our men are working full or part-time with private employers, or they're working part-time with Better Futures work crews. Nearly all of our men have issues of drug addiction, alcohol abuse, and a very high percentage of men are coping with a mental illness or some other type of behavioral health issue. To address these issues, all men receive physical exams and behavioral health assessments to identify concerns in these areas, provide access to appropriate services, and to promote better health. In 2008, the men reported they had paid over $80,000 in child support. Through our better business enterprises, we created more than 30 new jobs, providing reliable, quality labor for private employers. In addition, we have used the legislature's appropriation of $1.5 million to leverage more than $4.8 million other sources of private and public investment. Finally, we are about to engage researchers from John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York to conduct an independent analysis of our performance and to calculate the economic and social benefits of our work, including the amount of savings that we're generating for the state.
Thanks, McCrum. Our initial success in the network is... Our initial success in the network has been significant for several reasons. First, we're paid to perform. And in the next biennium, we're prepared to reduce our fixed rate by 25% if we're funded to double our enrollment. And we're willing to enter into a financial risk-sharing agreement with the state. This reimbursement approach provides a real incentive for us to produce better results. The second reason is our approach is built on proven practices that reduce public spending, reduce homelessness, increase employment rates, improve health outcomes, and reduce recidivism without compromising public safety. And our partners' collective track record and their collective power of services enables us to perform at a high level and meet expectations. I would like to close by offering some reasons for why the state should continue to sustain and grow a cost-saving endeavor like the network during this time of economic distress. We believe that the current economic crisis provides the legislature with a compelling and rare opportunity to be inventive, to reform ineffective practices, and to reduce spending on expensive options like prisons and other types of institutional settings. And House File 1732 provides partial funding for the type of bold, path-breaking reforms that are needed during this fiscal crisis. But serious reform is disruptive and threatening. Reform forces a change in current practices and in the status quo. Serious reform also entails more than tweaking a line item or instituting across-the-line bold spending cuts. Our reform is attempting to address complex issues that benefit multiple agencies and sectors, but it's hard for the current structures to adapt and finance our new approach. House File 1732 and similar bills being considered in other committees will help fuel the growth and development of the next generation of more effective public services for high-risk people. The network financing model, namely a fixed time-limited rate, pay for results, not activities, and pay a penalty if certain negative events occur, provides a better way to ensure that intended results are achieved and that the value of scarce tax dollars is maximized. And the network is a platform for governments and nonprofits to become much more enterprising and nimble. And we work toward achieving better results with fewer resources. Also, we intentionally enroll higher-risk adults who demonstrate some willingness to change. This is because research indicates that the targeting of scarce resources on higher-risk populations generates the greatest financial and social return and provides the most benefit to public safety. Third, House File 1732 is an investment strategy that will generate multiple benefits for multiple state sectors. within a relatively short time frame, and along the way will reduce spending and control future costs on more expensive services. Housing is a core feature of our cohesive approach, but no one agency or sector can assemble the necessary funding or assume complete responsibility for a comprehensive and path-breaking endeavor like the network. Multiple sectors must be engaged while we are held accountable for reducing state spending, increasing tax revenues and child support payments without compromising public safety. And finally, by continuing to invest in and grow the network, the legislature will ensure that more than 70 formerly homeless high-risk adults will not lose their housing or, for many, lose their jobs. And not funding will likely lead to higher costs related to higher prison recidivism rates and less economic activity. With ongoing support, these men and many more like them in the future can follow through on their commitment to transform their lives, to be productive workers, to be healthy people, to be responsible fathers and partners, and to be law-abiding citizens. These are high and, some may say, lofty expectations, but the network provides the ingredients, the accountability, and the environment needed to ensure that these bold aspirations are, in fact, realized. Thank you very much for this opportunity to testify today.
Thank you, Mr. Thomas. Are there any questions for the witnesses, or rather the testifiers?
Since we have several people here who can answer questions from their own experience who are part of the network, so please members to consider asking them questions.
Representative House.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First question, maybe Representative Clark. What current funding do they have or did they have? I think you might have mentioned it, but it went right over my head.
Madam Chair, Representative House, we currently, in the last triennium, there was one-time funding allocated, and it was in the public safety budget, so it's going through corrections right now. $1.55 million was allocated for the biennium.
Madam Chair, a couple of follow-ups. The other gentleman mentioned a contract with the Department of Corrections. Is that so the fiscal agent is Department of Corrections, and then they get the money to you, and then it's distributed? Okay, but I still have a few more follow-up questions, if that's okay. I don't want you to tell me what they earn, but do they earn above minimum wage? Unless you feel free to tell me what they earn per hour.
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative House, the men start at minimum wage, plus they have a subsidy for their rent. So the effective wage is about $12.50 an hour, plus they all have health insurance. But then we have a wage ladder, so based on your performance and your performance, you move up the wage ladder and could be earning within 3 to 6 months $9 an hour. But remember, we're not their long-term employer. We're meant to be the launching pad while they're looking for work and either going to school or training for a better job. But that's typically, our average wage is about, last time I looked, about $8 an hour.
Representative Holland.
Madam Chair, how do you let the public or these different businesses know that you exist and you're available?
Madam Chair, the more people you would tell, that's how we impart. We just got this brochure, which we passed out. But we've been, in the first 12 months, we have landed 5 steady customers who we love to death. And we're hoping to double them. And, you know, this is like any business strategy. The way we get more business often is that a pleased, satisfied customer tells one of their associates. So we're out aggressively marketing. We want to get the word out that our crews are available. You see Vincent here and Derek, they're in our uniforms. We go through morning inspection. And we want to be held accountable for beating anybody else who could compete for the same kind of work on both price and performance.
Madam Chair, I still have a couple. Okay,
Representative Holland.
Unless somebody else wants to. But, so you have these different contracts with different businesses, and the goal is to get these guys out from this program to a different job, maybe a better job, better life, whatever. But as you move people out, is there a waiting list that you move people in so you can continue to fulfill the contracts? And then if you fulfill these contracts and they pay money, where does that money go? Back into the system?
Mr. Thomas.
Madam Chair, and McCraw may want to address, we have worked with the corrections contract, we have established relations with the community corrections officers in both counties, and they help us identify men who meet the eligibility requirements. So they basically have a McCrom, for instance. Well, so with corrections, it's basically, I don't know, they know who's coming down the pike who is interested and meets our definition. So there's more than enough men to enroll. And then McCrom also goes out to the Hennepin County Workhouse. You may want to mention your process there.
And simply put, we...
Mr. Elamine.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We meet with the staff at the Hennepin County Workhouse, and they identify those short-term offenders as well as short-time offenders, and we interview them on a weekly basis, and we accept about 4 to 5 visits per month outside of either the Department of Corrections contract with us as well. So there's a steady influx, and there are more men that we cannot take than what we are actually servicing.
Madam Chair, if I may,
Representative
Howell, make sure I answer. So the money, what we've done then is, so we have a fixed rate with corrections, and as long as we can demonstrate that in the previous month we served an eligible man and we provided the basic set of intervention services, then we're reimbursed, and then about a third of that funding goes to the housing, the 130 units and the rent subsidies that we mentioned. Another third goes to help with the startup costs with our business enterprise, so mostly crew chiefs and some of the wages for participants. And then another third goes into direct services related to the coaching, the counseling that our staff. So that's a generally rough accounting, excuse me, of how we use the appropriation.
Well, Madam Chair, would there be no return from these the money that the businesses pay you for the service? Would there not be any return to the Department of Corrections or the state of some of that money to sort of almost like a revolving loan? You mm-hmm. kind of mm-hmm. pay money back to the state to help the program? Or?
Madam Chair, that's a great question. Our business model is that by year 4 or 5, we want this business to be generating net profits, and it's not happening yet, as with any new startup. What our vision was, not directly generating a return to the state, but we're able then to lower the rate that we charge the state because we have other sources of revenue. So it's getting to the same effect, I think, if I'm following your question, that our rate that we would charge the state goes down as we're able to diversify our revenues from primarily this business activity. So that is our long-range strategy and plan.
So, Madam Chair, one final, or Representative Clark, I'm sorry.
I was going to respond to another point, I guess, which is that you keep a lot of prison, saves a lot of money. And so, you know, the recidivism rate in itself is a return to the state. And we can probably do some quantification of that. I think you've actually put some of those numbers together. And
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Clark,
one last follow-up.
I kind of look at this as the Conservation Corps on steroids. you know, if the program works, it's a great idea. You know, if it continues to, if you continue to keep these folks out of trouble. And I caution you, don't let anything happen, because then you get painted with a bad mark. But, no, from what I hear, it sounds like a good idea. And hopefully you can turn this into somewhat of a profitable venture where you won't need to come to the state.
Right.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Clark and, Mr. Thomas and Representative Clark and others. This is a housing committee. Can you just kind of walk us through the housing portion of it? I know that you said that you have rent subsidies that you pay for the participants of the program, and can you kind of walk us through that, and then also give us a sense of, and maybe Ms. Solomon can give us a sense of what happens when someone comes out of the correctional facility and say they don't go into your program, they just kind of free to figure out how they house themselves and get work. Can you kind of walk us through that a tad bit?
Madam Chair,
Mr. Thomas,
Representative Hayden, that housing model that we've built and developed is based on an array of best practices from around the country, but there's two main ingredients. As I said, a third of our appropriation from the last biennium is being invested in housing. The first is initially we tried to just go and lease affordable housing units on the open market. That didn't work very well. Most of our men are declined rental at most of these housing communities, and it's primarily on their criminal history. So that's when we went to Plan B, which is we've gone to private landlords and we've leased their entire building, which in this economy they love, because we're basically guaranteeing rent. So then it's incumbent on us, to our business model, is make sure we keep those units full. So part of the housing investment is to master these units, and they're mostly in Minneapolis. We have one over here in Roseville. And then the other is to subsidize the man's rent. So a man has to pay at least $200 a month for their apartment. These are apartments, studios or one bedroom. And but we have a rent scale because over time their income should increase and their share of the rent should increase. So we're using the rent increases over a maximum of 24 months. I don't know if I'm direct answering here, but that's how it's working. And I would say, and we all know that, as it says on our cover sheet, housing is one of the core ingredients for stabilizing this high-risk population in the community and getting the return that we need in terms of public safety outcomes, in terms of economic outcomes, in terms of health outcomes. So that housing is not just a place to live. It's where we actually reinforce and practice a lot of our rituals and expectations of being a man in the network community or an adult in the network community.
Mr. Elamine.
Yes, and also to speak to the second part of the question, for those who more or less are not accepted in the network or we can't service in that particular way, so they're left just to on the open market and such, our experience has shown that they've been less likely to obtain housing, affordable housing, and quality housing, and they tend to find themselves back in the shelters and other public facilities that are, again, costing the state money in that particular way, too. So it's really a double-edged sword in that regard. It costs money, and they don't have stability. And therefore, as we have shown in our experience, and in the testimony, that they're more stable when they receive their housing, allow them to work on a regular basis, and then attend to the other issues of behavioral health, mental health, and other concerns that they may have at that point.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hayden.
I just have one follow-up question. Typically, when people get out of the workhouse or get out of a correctional facility, they have a parole officer or a probation officer, is that right?
Correct.
And typically, they need to go to an address so that the parole or probation officer needs to know where they are so that they can check in. So this also provides the parole or probation officer, the people from corrections, an opportunity to visit and know where the participant is living or the parolee is living. Is that correct as well?
Mr. Elamine.
Yes, that is absolutely correct. And we have a very good relationship with the agents, whether it's supervised release or intensive supervised release, which are the highest risk offenders that are coming being released from prison. And that is absolutely correct in terms of they need to have an address to go to, and we can provide that from day one from when they are released from prison.
And then one more follow-up question, if I may.
And I believe Mr. Thomas has.
Well, I just briefly, I wanted to add, amplify what McCrum. I think this is what we're trying to demonstrate is the correction officers have keys to our housing.
Mm-hmm.
Community corrections agents have keys to our housing. I don't think anybody's tried to integrate their service and social delivery model with another sector like that. And that brings a return to them, and it brings a return to us.
Representative Hayden. Oh, all right, thank you. And I believe we have one. Representative Severson, actually, is on the list.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I wonder if you can address, I got a few questions here. What is the fiscal note that you're asking for on this new appropriation?
Madam
Mr.
Chair.
Thomas.
The, if I understand your question correctly, we would argue that by enrolling the number of men that we'd like to enroll in the next biennium, that would generate a return in multiple ways for the state, over in human services, for instance, increase child support payments, pay, reduce welfare costs, and the housing investment generates a return in terms of increased income and lower use of expensive systems that the state currently funds.
And
Representative Hughes.
Thank you.
Oh,
I'm sure. Go ahead.
I apologize. Yes.
Mr. Thomas.
As it says on the last sheet, for us to reach the break-even point over the next 2 years, we're seeking a total of $6 million. But that we're seeking that from multiple sources. And so roughly if a third of the current expenditure appropriation is going for housing, a third of six is $2 million. So that would be the amount that we would suggest for this bill.
And
Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess that answers part of my question. My next question is, why is this here instead of public safety? You're saying that the housing portion of the allocation is for this committee. Madam Chair, just a follow-up question, a couple others. One is there's other programs out there, and there's MinCorp, which I think is a competitor program. Its cost per person is about $3,500. Yours is about $6,100. Mm-hmm. Why would we spend the almost twice as much to support your program rather than MinCorp?
Madam
Mr.
Chair,
Thomas.
Representative Severson, they're not the same. I've been with MinCorp many times. We go to their advisory meetings. They consider themselves as trying to change the culture and practice of the way inmates are prepared for release and then how they're supervised when they're released. That's not our niche. Our niche is a MinCorp matches up nicely with an endeavor like ours. We're complementary in that we provide the access to the housing, to the work, to the health care. Those are all features of our and the community experience. Those are all features that are complementary to and distinct from what MinCorp is doing. So I think we dovetail nicely with that reform effort. And I would suggest, as I said, in these times of really needing to rethink how we deliver services and finance those services, MinCorp is trying to do that reform in the way that we prepare and practice the reentry methods that we currently do. And we're building a model to ensure that those better practices get some of the long-term results that we're seeking. That's how I think of it.
Thanks, Madam Chair.
I will take this moment just to introduce some guests we have in case they might need to leave before we are finished with deliberations here. I would like to welcome the ninth grade students from St. Louis Park High School. Thank you for coming to hear our committee today. Representative Clark, do you have any? Oh, I'm sorry. Representative McFarland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have one quick question to follow up on the funding sources that you have. What percentage is state funding versus contract funding versus, I see you're also supported by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Just rough estimates, please.
Madam Chair, Representative McFarland, about a third of the legislative appropriation covers, about a third of our revenue is the legislative appropriation. The earned income from our business activity, it was about $280,000 last year. That's about, I can't do the percentages in my head. And then we also have a contract with the Hennepin County to enroll another. So we're not enrolling exclusively DOC referrals. And then the private funding is necessarily designed to cover our startup costs in the first 3 years. So if you be happy to share, we have a five-year financial plan that shows in year four we're no longer relying on philanthropic funding, although Robert Wood Johnson is paying the cost of the independent evaluation. So that will continue beyond their grant.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In a follow-up to this question, you said that in year four, the philanthropic funding will be not needed anymore. Is that your hope for state funding as well?
Madam
Mr.
Chair.
Thomas.
No. What our objective is, again, we're a demonstration. What we hope is by that time we will prove that yes, there will be an ongoing state investment. As we discussed earlier, it would be declining because hopefully we'll have other sources of revenue. But that what we're trying to demonstrate is that the state is always going to be grappling with a high-risk population with some complex issues, and that there will continue to be value in purchasing our product. Now, if we don't make that case and we don't prove it, then you don't buy it. I mean, it's that simple. Mm-hmm. And that's why, you know, the one-time funding isn't something that bothers us, because I think it sets out a benchmark. Look, prove it, come back. If you can demonstrate that you're getting that return, then you reinvest, and maybe at a different rate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then just another question, if I could, Madam Chair.
Scott,
you made reference to hopefully you know, spending less, it would be less of a burden on the welfare system and more child support repaying. Do you have something in place to track that kind of those numbers?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Thomas.
Yes, we do. And we have a full-time person who's focused on, one, they built the database, and in fact, Mr. Hudson is one of our inputters. So now, when a new participant comes in, there's a slew of data that we put in about them. And then how often are we updating that, Macron?
On a daily basis.
Mr. Alamine.
Really on a daily basis, as events occur and items change in their particular situations, whether it's work, income, any changes in their supervisional status, anything like that, as well as income and what they're contributing back, as well as child support and other restitution.
And then just one more question, if I could.
Right. We do have two more bills to get through today, members, so we would like to move along. Representative Scott,
thank you. Just one last question, and just to make it clear, there's no really duplication between what you do and what NNCOR does. It's all, I mean, it's totally different. Mr. Thomas.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott. Yes, I don't think there's duplication. You could certainly ask the department. I mean, we meet regularly with them, but as the way it's designed is, NNCOR is investing in the preparation of people before release and then in the community supervision of them once they're released. We're not community corrections authorized or whatever, but we work closely with those agents, and I think that's how we can demonstrate that collectively these are two future-focused practices, and we should both get a bigger bang for the buck as a result.
That's all. Thank you. I appreciate mm-hmm. you being here. Representative Clark, do you have any concluding comments before you renew your motion?
I hope you see the value of this investment, and I can have it be considered for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Looks like there's a small question over there. One of my assistants.
Representative Huntley.
I don't have a question. I have a comment. So, if you want.
All right.
I can do it now or do it later.
Now would be fine, and then we will.
Okay. I would just say that I'm a big fan of measurement and measuring what you're doing, and this is the one of two groups I know of in this area that are really do the measurement. And we don't know for sure yet whether this is going to work or be successful, but I can tell you by the time the 5 years are up, we will know whether it worked. And that is a real plus in this area.
Representative McNamara, do you have a question?
Well, I have a question right along Representative Huntley's lines. I'm wondering if the department wants to weigh in on their feelings on how this has measured up so far in its short time. And they're standing in the back, but they're not hearing that we're talking about them. I was wondering, Madam Chair, if the department wanted to weigh in on the measurement of this program in the short time that it's been here.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Tanya Orr from the Housing Finance Agency. I am aware of the legislation, and I did go back and look at the the authorizing legislation from 2007, but I frankly am not very familiar with the project at all. And Ms. Cass and I were just talking about, is this money just going to be for rental assistance? Because the employment stuff is not anything that the Housing Finance Agency is has any expertise on, and other than we help, we help construction workers get jobs, but we don't. But that's just because we're funding housing. So I don't really have anything else to say other than I know you are aware of the fact that the governor is proposing the 5% reduction in our budget, and that's in addition to the loss of the one-time only money. So I would hope that you would find some other funding and not go into further into our base to fund something that's not been in our programs before.
Hi, I'm Barbara Cox from the Department of Corrections, and this is not, of course, housing, of course, is not our expert area, but I can tell you that the Department of Corrections worked with our budget committee on some information about the measurement piece that we were going to present this week. That meeting's been canceled. I think, all budget discussions right now are a little bit on hold. But if the committee is interested, there is a study, an independent evaluation of the network that was done by the Improve Group, and that is something that the legislature, required of the funding of this grant. And the Improve Group, again, is separate from the department, but that information is available. And separate from that, the M-Corp program that the department has in three pilot counties, Hennepin, Ramsey, and Rochester, which is somewhat similar to this, but not exactly the same, there is also an evaluation being done. Now, of course, there's very little data on both of the programs because they're so new, but if the committee is interested, I can for sure send you the Improved Group report as well as the information we have so far compiled on the M-Corp program that is somewhat similar in its wraparound services.
Thank you, Ms. Cox. Done. Okay. Representative Clark.
Just renew my motion, Madam Chair.
That's right. This bill 1732 will be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Taylor, for helping us out there. And the next bill today is from Representative Gardner. Representative Gardner, welcome to the committee. I know you've been working on this bill real hard, and you have some report to give us, and people who I think you want to testify.
So yeah, I guess
we need to move this bill
right
Forward. Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll move House File 356, and I just need to know where it needs to go. Is it going to Finance?
Temporarily, we're going to hold it. We're going to have it laid on the.
Well, we're going to lay it over.
Yep.
Temporarily. I will move that we lay over House File 356 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Morgan. I could move the whole thing to your office with all the issues, but if you want to, also. Madam Chair, here's what I'd like to do. I appreciate moving the bill. I do have a delete all, which really reflects the consensus, the position of the two major stakeholders in the issue, and that way we'll get it engrossed as an unofficial committee engrossment, and I think that's that
Morgan
works.
I'll move
that way we can have a basis for the agencies to maybe look at that for a fiscal impact.
Thank you. Just put the bill in the order that you would...
Yes.
Madam Chair, I'll move the A090151 amendment.
The amendment is before us. Representative Gardner, is there any discussion to put the bill in the... in the way that the actual author would like to have it considered today? Any discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails, and the bill as amended is before us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is one of the more complicated bills I've worked on in my short time in the House, with lots of moving parts, and I've had the chance just in the last 10 days or so to step up and meet with a lot of the stakeholders and try and solve a persistent problem. This actually would revise the 2007 legislation that we had to create a manufactured home relocation trust fund. The idea was that we have about 50,000 households, or 4% of Minnesota's population, that lives in manufactured housing, what we used to call mobile homes, and many of those were often just treated as personal property and real property. I may recall I worked in some foreclosure protection bills on this last year. But the Relocation Trust Fund has to deal with the fact that the folks who live in manufactured home parks don't usually own the land on which the their home sits. And if a manufactured home park owner decides to sell that property to create some other purpose, whether it's another type of housing or some commercial development, that those folks have to go. And the manufactured home isn't necessarily as mobile as maybe we'd like to believe. And so people are really left without a whole lot of choice but to have to pick up the cost to relocate their home somewhere else. The idea behind the Home Relocation Trust Fund was to have the manufactured homeowners, the people who own the mobile home, pay into this fund, which then can be dispersed to help pay up to a certain amount of money to help people relocate. So it's almost like a small shelf self-insured pool. The problem is that the fund has not been as solvent as it could be. So if more parks were to close in a significant enough number, the fund would pretty much go dry. I naively assumed that up until last Friday that all manufactured park owners and all manufactured homeowners were familiar with the legislation and knew of their obligations under the 2007 legislation, which, by the way, was introduced by a former colleague, Representative Krantz, is now my constituent, and I need to call him up and drag him down here and see what he's done. No, I'm just kidding. I'd like to see him, but the amount of money here we're talking about in the fund, we're talking about in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. You know, if we were talking about housing that was, you know, in my neck of the woods in Shoreview or North Oaks, there would be private sector operators in the insurance market who would just love to help you out. But these are folks who often have been left out of that private sector market. And we have had this trust fund set up, and people have been had payments dispersed out of this fund. But we're concerned that if trends continue, that it will be insolvent. So after talking with the stakeholders, we've kind of approached it in a certain way. The original bill, which is now no more, would just use the renter's credit fund as a way to help support that. Personally, I felt that manufactured homeowners ought to know of their responsibilities because they would derive some benefits, so they should have some responsibility to know what they should do and pay into the system rather than trying to deduct something from renter's credit. The advocates, the mobile justice folks for the All Parks Alliance for Change, had a proposal to just ask the park owners to assess that as a fee on rent for $12 a year, a dollar per month, and the park owners didn't really want to go down that route either. So I got them in a room on Friday, and the delete all is the product of where we found some consensus items. I won't say that it's a perfect solution yet, but it beefs up the existing system where manufactured park owners go to the residents and they ask for the payment. Then they have a form that was already provided by MMB that says here's the people who paid, here's the people who didn't pay it, and here's the remittance altogether of those payments. I found out that roughly half the manufactured park owners were not even filing at all. So what the bill does is say, all right, if MMB receives no word from a manufactured home park, then they will send an invoice for If you have 100 lots and it's $12 for $12 times 100 lots, and then the manufactured park owners would essentially assess it or collect it in whatever method works best. So we have kind of a hybrid system. There are some folks who are making a good faith effort who are abiding by the legislation that was passed before, who are figuring out who paid and who didn't, and they send it into the state. And so that system would still be in place. It's still a little cumbersome. It would be simpler just to assign rent, but in the interest of gaining consensus, we'd like to, you know, go along with the folks who are making a good faith effort in, among the park owners, but essentially provide another tool to bring in the revenue from the park owners who are not participating or even communicating with the state. The old legislation didn't require the state to actually send out the forms that are on their website to the park owners, so a lot of park owners didn't even know where to go look for this stuff. So the bill does say MMD will send out the form to the roughly 900 park owners in the state, and then the park owners take care of the rest. I have a couple of testifiers. The folks from APAC can tell you a little bit about where we're trying to go with this. And I think the park owners would like to say a few words, and I think some members of the Mobile Justice Group would like to speak also.
Go ahead and invite your witnesses. That we're going to have about 10 minutes. We have about 10 minutes, so everybody.
Certainly.
Here, so.
And I was just going to say, I did speak to MMB yesterday by email, and they, you know, wondering whether they're going to have increased fiscal impact, so that's one reason we're sort of holding it over so they can take a look at it. I heard back from AHFA this morning about the extension of the sunset of the backup plan, which is MHFA essentially making the fund solvent if there's an emergency, and that's with the sunset June 30th of this year. So we still have some issues to work out there.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. If you just introduce yourself, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Justin Bell. I'm the Legal and Policy Director for All Parks Alliance for Change. APAC is a statewide group that represents the interests of residents of manufactured home communities. Madam Chair and committee members, the Manufactured Home Relocation Trust Fund provides manufactured homeowners throughout the state with protection in the event of a park closing. In 2007, the state legislature established the trust fund to protect some 50,000 families and households from the threat they face when their parks close. All the administrative costs of running the fund come out of the trust fund and come out of the homeowner contributions of $12 annually. The method to collect the $12 annually so far has not worked. If a homeowner does not contribute their $12, they're not eligible for compensation should their park close. Right now, less than half of all manufactured homeowners have paid into the trust fund or are eligible under the trust fund. There are hundreds of manufactured parks that have not complied with state law so far, and none of the residents of those parks have even given the chance to become covered under the trust fund so far. Representative Gardner's proposal is, I will agree, is not a perfect solution, but it does encompass the level of agreement that we have so far. With me today, I have some members of our organization, including someone who's been through a park closing, someone who's threatened with park closing, and also a member of the APAC staff that will speak briefly to racial disparities under the current law.
Thank you. Just that, yeah.
Stand.
Well, and can you move next to the microphone, please, and then introduce yourself.
Yes, my name is Deb Adrian. I am the president of the APAC Board of Directors, and I am a result of a park closing. April 1st, 2005, I purchased a brand new double-wide manufactured home in a park called City Lane in Bloomington. June 1st, I was notified that the park was going to close. After the initial shock, I came to my senses and started asking questions. How do I move this? How much is it going to cost? And where do I move it? Cost was $10,000 to move my home. It would have been financially devastating for me. I was fortunate in that Bloomington had a park closing ordinance, a relocation ordinance, but it was not, the trust fund had not been established yet. As a result, five families in Bloomington had to be subsidized. They would have been homeless as a result of this park closing. The point that I want to make is this is unsubsidized housing. People that live in parks fend for themselves, make do, get by in this society, in this financial hard time. If a park closes, it could be financially devastating for thousands of people in this state, and they would have to be subsidized, and what a tragedy that would be. So the relocation trust fund language please, I plead with you, please amend this so that people are protected under this law. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Adrian.
Can I go next?
Welcome to the committee.
Chair McCarthy and committee members, thank you for giving me the chance to say something. My name is Sandra Boone, and I live in a manufactured home in St. Anthony. I own my own home. I pay taxes. I have homeowner's insurance, and as my constituent said here, Beth, is we pay our own way, all right? But we don't own the land, like representative said. We don't own the land that we sit on. If a park would close, the owner decides to close it, I would automatically be displaced. I'd have to go somewhere else. I would prefer to be able to relocate my home or to be compensated for if it's not possible to do that. As stated by our attorney at APAC, in 2007, the Minnesota legislators passed that law to have that fund, and I think that includes pretty much everybody here that was involved in that, and I appreciate it. I thank you for doing that. The problem is it isn't working. We still have over half of the people in the state of Minnesota that would not be compensated and couldn't relocate. We are talking about thousands of dollars, even for just a small home. They're not trailers, they're homes, and it costs quite a bit to move them. Now, two legislations have gone by, and we don't have sufficient money in there in case a particularly big park would close or more than one park would close. And what would happen with me and with a lot of other people is we would be forced to have to go into subsidized housing. And that's not what we want to do. We're used to paying our own way. We especially in this economy don't want to be a burden on the state. That's why this is so important that it doesn't happen. Affordable housing that doesn't cost the state anything is good for everybody. And that's what we want to try and have. In effect, the law that you passed in 2007 isn't working for the people that you wanted it to be for. Because our incomes just don't put us in that position where we can just up and go. I would strongly urge that you vote in favor of the proposed amendment, which would better ensure that all manufactured homeowners have the option to relocate or be compensated. Thereby, you would be accomplishing what the intent and the purpose of the original bill was for. That's all we're asking for. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Why don't we move the chair over there so you can sit down?
Yeah, thank you.
There you go. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Hannah Garcia. I'm a community organizer with All Parks Alliance for Change. And I just wanted to make a really quick point that anytime people are being systematically excluded, people of color are often disproportionately impacted. Through our organizing and our outreach, we are to consistently hear from families of color that they are being denied the right to participate in a trust fund. So the current proposal would resolve these inequities and ensure that all of Minnesota's manufactured homeowners would be protected in the event of a park closing. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's important information. Any other comments or questions from committee members? Representative Hayden.
Madam Chair, thank you. Can you expound on that issue of people of color being excluded? Is that, can you talk a little more about that? I just don't understand why they would be systematically excluded unless they were just part of the half of the folks that aren't getting this benefit. Can you
talk?
Yeah, well, we have, through a lot of our kind of community meetings, families have come together and said that they either never got paperwork, or if they did get paperwork that asked for them to pay, it's been in English, and so there are also a lot of language barriers around the trust fund. So that's one of the names.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Representative Peterson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess to that point, the individuals that are receiving these notices, are they going to the park owners as well, so the park owners understand what is required, and then it would be the responsibility of the park owner to relay to the park constituents that this is their option to jump into this program and actually have some, what I would call, insurance.
Madam Chair, Representative Severson, the current law does not the finance actually has a very nice website with the forms on there, but there's no requirement to actually get the information with the notice to the park owners. That's kind of the hang-up. So the amendment says, all right, MMB sends the form and says, here's the notice. The notice is already listed in statute of what it's supposed to say to the resident, and they get it to the resident. If we had the state mailing out 50,000, you know, envelopes for this stuff, then it sort of, you know, you wipe out the reason for the fund in the first place, because you'd probably wipe it out right there, just the mailing to 50,000 residents. Mm-hmm. But the idea is the state goes to the park owners are the conduit for the information to the park residents. But I discovered as of last week, you know, not that information is not even getting to the owners in a lot of cases. And in some cases, when it is, they're not doing anything with it.
And a follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Gardner, I guess I'm wondering what the cost to the fiscal note is for the Department of MMB, basically. And do they have the current manpower, or is this an addition to? Is there a proposal that they've put together that would facilitate the process that you're talking about?
Madam Chair and Representative Seastrom, that's why I'm asking that the bill be held over so it can get an engrossment and finance can, or MMB can take a look at it and determine what their cost would be.
Yes.
Also to that point, Madam Chair, Representative Seastrom, the administrative costs for trust fund have historically been paid out of the trust fund. And for MMB, there's also been instances in the past where they've contracted out some of that work, and that contract has been paid through the trust fund itself.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes. Representative McNamara?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I'm over on this side today.
I see.
Right, sorry. Hey, I just got a question. Representative Gardner, are the folks that, do the park owners have a representative here today? And I'm wondering, Madam Chair, I've got a couple questions for them, and maybe I can, as they get ready to come up. Representative Gardner, I would think they would be making a mistake not getting this information out, because I would think they would have some potential liability to be responsible for all this moving expense if, under current law, they're supposed to be giving this information out and decide not to do that. Why wouldn't they, under current law, end up being responsible for all that cost if they're supposed to be giving the park residents options? And I guess that would be my question for you and for the owners. I think they're making a huge mistake not getting this information out.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, the whole issue of enforcement and what actually pushes people to do that, I think, is a key question, and we're trying to find the most efficient way to do this. The issue of enforcement has always come up, and I think we have a big question mark there. And, what we'd like to see, if this legislation goes through as amended, that we'd actually see a huge boost in the number of parks that are actually reporting and providing receipts into the fund, and then we can figure out how to tweak it now. But I think Mr. Bruner might actually have some perspectives to share now.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Mark Bruner. I'm the president of the Minnesota Manufactured Modular Housing Association, and we have about 450 members. In 2006, we built about 4,000 manufactured modular homes in the state. We also represent the manufactured home community owners, who are the ones that you're talking about here, are manufactured home park owners. And, you know, we were involved in the initial bill and did support it and joined AIPAC and the advocates in the governor's office when the bill was signed. It was a lot of work to pull together the compromise. And what we've been doing as an organization to answer your question about informing people that they're responsible to pay is, you know, each year since the trust fund has been in effect, is we've done multiple mailings to every licensed manufactured home park in the state, and the way you collect that information is from the Department of Health as well as multiple counties and municipal governments who do the licensure. So aside from contacting all of our members, we put seminars on, had attorneys present explaining that you must comply and here's how you do it. We helped design the forms that were posted on MMB's website. And what we have found is that, of those manufactured home communities that comply and make a concerted effort to encourage the residents to pay, that it's it's about half of the residents that decide to pay. I mean, you know, the issues are, is your property closing? And the owner, you know, no, it's not. Well, gee, why would I, you know, why would I write that check out kind of thing? Now, there may be those that, for some reason, don't get the notice. You know, I'll be honest with you, the addresses that we have many times from the state don't appear to be accurate because we get the mail back. So we do the best we can, but we appreciate what Representative Gardner has done, especially now with the amendments since the original bill ran into issues with the Department of Revenue in terms of the CRP format, in being able to address the issue of notification of everyone that they're required to pay. You know, something coming from the state of Minnesota to all license holders saying that you have this obligation to disseminate this information to each of your residents would certainly carry more weight than a letter from us or encouragement. And for that, you know, we think Representative Gardner is on the right track in raising awareness and compliance.
Mr. McNair?
Well, if I could just have a follow-up. Mr. Berner, wouldn't your park owners be concerned about their liability currently if they don't disseminate this information?
Mm-hmm.
I would think they would be very concerned about a potential lawsuit if the park was to end up closing. So I hope you're working with Representative Gardner. I mean, I agree. The idea is we should get the information to the park residents, but I hope that your park owners are also aware there's a law in place that they're supposed to be disseminating some information, and if they willfully decide not to disseminate that information, there may be consequences for them that are unfortunate.
Madam Chair, as a matter of fact, in one of our newsletters to our members last fall, it emphasized that very issue, that you need to comply. There could be liabilities. And to a point made earlier by a previous witness, if there is a closure and the residents have paid their $12, the owners of the properties are on the hook as well to pay into the fund, you know, $5,000-$6,000 in terms of helping to offset the cost of relocation. So it's really a joint effort in terms of how the fund gets funded, if you will.
Okay. Just one thing before we do the final closure, I want to say that Ms. Garcia's comments were very important to talk about the need for the information to be in languages that people can understand. And we do have requirements in some of our other state agencies that when there are significant populations that do not speak English, that they produce the documents in two or three different languages. So I'd just like to advise the two of you in your negotiations to think about that and who you would presume would take responsibility for that. There's certainly precedent for it in Minnesota law. So, with that, the bill will be laid over, and remember the main purpose is to get a fiscal note for House File 356. Thank you. We have one more bill before us, members. Representative Murphy. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And Representative Lane?
Yes, I would like to move the House File 587 for possible inclusion.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome
and members.
To the committee.
House File 587 is, I think, an important piece of legislation for the consideration of this committee as you're dealing with the issue of public health. The purpose for this bill is to move Minnesota in the direction of addressing violence that uses sex as a public health issue. The bill proposes testing a framework for how the state might, in the future, allocate public health resources to stop violence that uses sex. The bill requests an appropriation of $250,000 over the biennium as a one-time allocation to develop, test, and evaluate the use of community-based prevention grants as a strategy for advancing the state's sexual violence prevention plan,
which is already developed, through community-based initiatives. I'd like to introduce to the committee Donna Dunn, who's the executive director of MNCASA, to further explain the need and the demonstration grant proposal, and I thank you very much for your time.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you, Representative Murphy, for that introduction. I am very pleased to be here to talk about the need for enhancing our ability to prevent violence that uses sex in our work in Minnesota. And so we're here to talk a little bit today about making prevention of sexual violence a Minnesota priority. The goal of this presentation is really just to start the conversation about how we make the primary prevention of violence that uses sex a Minnesota priority. And hopefully we can expand Minnesota's focus on violence using sex, taking this from primarily the public safety sector, which is where most of our issues have come at the legislature, into the public health arena. The objectives of this presentation are really, as you see on the screen, to explain the impact and the cost of sexual violence in Minnesota and to propose this framework to initiate state funding for sexual violence prevention, as was referred to. I'd like to tell you a little bit about the cost of sexual violence in Minnesota. We have a study that was then called The Cost of Sexual Violence that was done by the Minnesota Department of Health, and there are some key points I'd like to really focus your attention to. First of all, this report indicated that in 2005, probably 61,000 Minnesotans were sexually assaulted. And because sexual assault is something that typically is experienced more than one time by a survivor, we understand those 61,000 assaults or individuals probably experienced somewhere around 77,000 assaults. That's enough to fill the metro bill, a large number of people. The second key point I'd really like to make you aware of is that this issue had this kind of financial and economic impact on the state, an $8 billion economic impact during one year, in the year of 2005. And then the last key point that I want to make you aware of is that not all of those $8 billion were direct costs to the state, but a large number is. Approximately $130.5 million is really what the state's investment in working with offenders, the criminal justice system and perpetrator treatment. About $90.5 million has to do with victim medical care and victim intervention and support. And the last figure is the one we'd like you to pay attention to. There are zero state dollars that are directed to the primary prevention of sexual violence in Minnesota. Those are three key points that came out of the report. As I said, this is a report that was done by the Minnesota Department of Health in conjunction with the Pacific Institute for Research and Evaluation. They have conducted these kinds of cost studies around several issues across the country. This was published in July of 2007 and is based on 2005 data. Some of the details from the report are these. For the people who were, 61,000 people who were sexually assaulted in 2005, according to the data in the study, 25% of those were young people. So we're talking about people under the age of 18. And of that number, 80% of those victims were female, were girls. The remaining 75%, therefore, are adults, and of those, 72% were women. This is an issue that, according to the study, has statewide impact. We know that people of color, Native American women, for example, are disproportionately affected by sexual violence. They report at rates much higher than the majority population. We also know that other vulnerable communities, such as the gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender community, older people, people with disabilities, are also disproportionately targeted by offenders for sexual violence. Well, back to the cost a little bit. We understand that the $8 billion is truly a fraction of the total cost. It does not, in fact, given the way that the data is collected, it probably misses some large vulnerable populations in Minnesota. It doesn't address the women who are sexually violated through prostitution, who are prostituted, or youth who are prostituted. It doesn't probably capture people who are institutionalized, people who are non-native English speakers, youth who are runaways, who are living on the streets, and so forth. So we know that some significant vulnerable populations haven't even been captured in this snapshot. So we know, and then also the figure did not capture local costs that are not actually state dollars that are contributed to or that are invested in responding to crime of the local community. So local law enforcement costs, local prosecution costs, and so forth wouldn't be covered. Another thing about the cost is that half of the cost in the report really are from assault on children, from child victims. It averages out to about $1,540 per Minnesota resident. We take that $8 billion and spread it across our state. And this is three times as large as the cost to the state for alcohol-impaired driving. Now, I know that we speak more publicly about alcohol-impaired driving than we do sexual violence or violence that uses sex, and that's part of the issue that we are challenged with. The government spending, as we said, the total was $221 million between offenders and victims. 59% of that $221 million is perpetrator costs for inpatient treatment, for confinement, and so forth. 41% of that cost is for those people who have been sexually assaulted, the victims and survivors. And the largest part of that really is the Medicaid cost for medical care. I'd like you to know that there are victim services in many counties in Minnesota, but we still have 13 counties and several reservations that do not have 24-hour-a-day services. So we are about $1 million below need in terms of just that intervention. In terms of prevention, the money that we have to work with in Minnesota really comes through the CDC and through the state Department of Health. There is zero state funding for primary prevention at this point. At the conclusion of the cost report, there was really only a sort of a general recommendation, and it's the one that you see here, that policy recommendations aimed at preventing sexual violence before it occurs should be vigorously pursued, adopted, and sustained. And that's a part of what we are wanting to address here, which is our policy initiative that we want to speak about that Representative Murphy introduced. We are proposing prevention demonstration grants that would help develop this framework for a state approach to preventing sexual violence prior to it happening. What we would do is set up some pilot sites to develop, test, and evaluate the application of a model that we've developed and we use very effectively around criminal justice partner collaboration. So this is called our SMART model. We would like to take what we have learned from that SMART model and apply it to developing multidisciplinary community-based prevention teams. We are talking about $350,000 for these demonstration grants to develop these three test teams, pilot teams, and to manage the project and to evaluate the outcomes. We're looking for one-time funding to test this concept. This House File 587 proposes that we use the general fund appropriation for this, but we know this has developed prior to the announcement of some of the stimulus funding, which has just come to the state of Minnesota, and we are aware that this kind of project could in fact compete for some of those burn grant monies that have come into the state of Minnesota. That has happened subsequent to us introducing this bill in the legislature. We have a couple of other policy initiatives that we are would like you to know about because it applies to the Minnesota Department of Health, and that is we have started this process of supporting counties in stepping out at a county level to prioritize the prevention of violence that uses sex. And one of the things that the health department could do is really support that initiative in bringing all 87 counties on board at some level of awareness about what they can be doing through their county policies and their county work to prevent sexual violence. And finally, there are really no licensing and certification requirements for anybody working in health fields in Minnesota, that they understand sexual violence, that they can appropriately screen for it, that they know how to intervene if they're seeing it when they're working with somebody. And so we would like the health department to really identify the need, to really research this issue and identify the need and the appropriateness for healthcare providers in Minnesota. And finally, I think I said finally once, but this is perhaps the last finally. We have maybe it isn't. Okay. but we have, we would like you to be aware, April is Sexual Assault Awareness Month. This is something that we observe in Minnesota and that is really observed across the nation. And we have an event at our offices, which are on the 10th floor of the Kelly Inn, called the Aware Event. We will be honoring five individuals and organizations in the state for the awareness that they have raised around sexual violence, and we would encourage you to come and join us. The event is from 4:30 till 7 p.m. It's a good opportunity to network with people and talk about the issue and also have some fun. And then we will be premiering a DVD that we did in conjunction with Cincinnati Public Television called Stop Sexual Violence, Listen and Lead. It will be aired on TPT Channel 2 on April 19th at 9 p.m. and then aired again at 1 p.m. on one of their new digital channels, which is TPT Life, and that will be on April 26th. And so we encourage you to watch that. You will see quite an array of individuals talking about the need for sexual violence prevention. I thank you for this opportunity, and I would be very happy to answer questions about this issue and the proposed legislation.
Thank you very much for the presentation for the bill, Representative Murphy. Are there questions, comments from committee members? No, we're just about out of time. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just ask one simple question. The statistic about the cost of sexual violence reports, the 25%, the statistics there, I guess. My question is, are those reports or actual convictions?
Those would be reports. Because one of the, I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Representative, yes, one of the things that we do struggle with in this issue is the vast majority of sexual assault incidents are never reported, in fact. The battle that we're facing around both intervention and prevention is that this is a very hidden crime that affects a huge number of people. So we're talking about incidents, not necessarily reports. Thank you.
Yeah, I wanted to just ask a question in terms of the cost and so on. I became aware, for a very unfortunate reason, of some of the issues surrounding post-traumatic stress syndrome related to people who are sexual assault victims. Are those costs and some of the interventions at work, are they included in here? I'm thinking some of the medical reprogramming, whatever, people really trying to get through the nightmare of what they have experienced. Those costs, are they included, or is that something you're going to be looking at? Or?
Madam Chair, those costs should be included in this report, would be included in the report. Mm-hmm. There, the report does focus on the medical interventions necessary typically for a sexual assault survivor, the loss of quality of life, issues related to future, perhaps chemical dependency, homeless issues, other health-related issues. We know that, for example, the adverse child effects, child experience report indicates that children who have these kinds of experiences as children have increased health costs as they reach adulthood. All of those really have been taken into account in this report. And the report's available on the Minnesota Department of Health website with a very detailed methodology about where the data came from, where the numbers came from.
And does it include lost work time and that sort of thing as well?
Yes, it would include lost work time.
All right. Thank you.
If I may, I would also like to point out that in 2003, the Health Department did develop a brochure about some priorities around sexual and domestic violence prevention and intervention. And one of the strategies that they mentioned is to replicate our SMART team model, collaborative model, as a way to increase the local conversation and local expertise around sexual violence prevention. So this has been a direction that the Health Department has looked at and has supported in the past.
Just two other comments. Mm-hmm. One is, I think the cost-benefit analysis, whatever you can give us on that, I think would be very, very helpful. Mm-hmm. What we save by investing in this sort of a program. Mm-hmm. Second, can you tell us what any other states might be doing this point in time?
Madam Chair, we are fortunate to have a lot of support from the Centers for Disease Control around the prevention work. And the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault works closely with the Health Department around our developing of prevention models and strategies in our state. What we continue to learn when we go to national meetings, and usually it's somebody from the Health Department and I, that they're representing Minnesota, what we continue to hear is Minnesota is leading. And that is a little bit frightening to us because we feel that we are certainly have great ideas and good strategies, but we feel like we are all really inventing a new wheel. And in fact, the CDC has said they have no actually proven prevention strategies that they can offer us as states to take forward and use. There are not any strategies that have been tested that are specific to sexual violence. And so one of the things that we would be doing here is being able to offer information about a strategy that we think bears some really positive potential, and we would love to be able to take that back. I would like to say that the SMART model that we use with multidisciplinary collaborative teams that are at a county level and that's focused on reporting and investigating and prosecuting sexual assault has become the national model, and we now provide technical assistance on that work across the nation to sexual assault teams. So there's some good track, we have a good track record for this kind of collaborative work, and we'd like to take it into the area of prevention.
Okay. Thank you very much. There's no further discussion, and this bill will also be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Okay.
Thank you. We have the minutes before us, sorry. The minutes of March 17th, and it's just like Mr. Rosenthal, have you had a chance to look at them?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd like to move the minutes.
Okay. Representative Rosenthal moves the approval of the minutes of March 17th. Mm-hmm. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails, and the minutes are approved and adopted. Committee members, I want to thank you for your attention today, and we'll be meeting again next Tuesday. Meeting is adjourned.